All right. Good morning, everyone. I think we got a lot of stuff to cover this morning, and since this is a subject matter, we don't need a quorum. So we're going to go ahead and get started, and as members show up, we'll add them to the roll. But if we could go ahead and call the roll, please.
Senator Aquino. Senator Bailey. Here. Representative Davidsmeyer.
Here.
Senator DeWitt. Representative Ellick. Representative Grant. Representative Hernandez. Senator Kaler. Representative Moeller. Senator Sims. Senator Severson.
Okay, we have eight members here. Chair Kaler and I decided that I'm going to run the first part of the show, and he's going to run the second part. So I'll take care of the revenue estimate side, and he's going to handle the insurance side. So I will turn it over to you, Clayton, on the update on the economic revenue side.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the commission. I am Clayton Klinke, executive director of the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. As you'll recall, we had our regular revenue update meeting back on March 8th this year, and later that same month on March 22nd, we did our group insurance meeting. With the early adjournment, we did not present a formal update on our revenue number prior to the passage of the FY23 budget, so we felt it was important to schedule a revenue update during the veto session. Because we have seen some significant performance in the revenue sources. As you may have seen in the news yesterday, the Governor's Office of Management and Budget released their annual economic and fiscal policy report, which included a substantial increase in their FY23 revenue estimate compared to the enacted budget framework. Today, we will also be updating our revenue number with another substantial increase compared to that enacted budget number. This reflects continued strength in our core revenue sources, as well as some one-time revenue receipts which will not likely reoccur in FY24. The second part of our meeting today will focus on retiree health care, the Trail MAPD coverage for the retirees in the State Employee Group Insurance Program. For this portion of the hearing, we have several panels including CMS, healthcare vendors, and representatives of retirees. With covering two separate topics today, I think this will be one of our longer meetings that we've had, so I'd like to move right into the revenue update portion. For that, I'm joined at the table by two of our members of COGFA staff. Next to me, I have Eric Noggle. Eric is the manager of our revenue unit at COGFA, and I'm also joined by Ben Varner, who is the chief economist at COGFA. And Ben will lead off our presentation. He'll go through the PowerPoint that you've each been given, the first portion of that dealing with economic variables, and then Eric will do the second portion in relation to the actual numbers and revenue performance.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman, members of the Commission. I am Ben Varner. I'm the Chief Economist of the Commission. We'll get right into it. On page 5, you'll see real gross domestic product. Basically, this is one of the broadest measures of the economy, made up with personal consumption, investment, government spending, and net exports. So you can see here, In the second quarter of 2020, at the beginning of the outbreak, we had a large decline, almost 30%, and then a rebound in the next quarter as the economy started to reopen. 2021 saw solid growth between 6.3% to 7% for most of the quarters, except for the quarter three was only 2.7%, and this is due to the Delta variant. So we had strong growth throughout 2021. Going into 2022, we saw a slowdown and actual contraction. In the first quarter, we saw a decline of 1.6% in the first quarter and 0.6% in the second quarter. Now, this is two consecutive quarters of contraction. Often this is thought of as a recession. However, this is masking a actually really strong economy when you look more at jobs and the consumer spending side. The first quarter was dragged down by net exports being quite high, imports being quite high. And then the second quarter, we saw a change in inventories and a slowdown related to housing, which we'll go into in greater talk about the tightening of monetary policy by the Federal Reserve. The third quarter saw a rebound as net exports improved, and we grew at 2.6%. Looking forward, if you look at forecasters right now, most of them are calling for some sort of recession in the future. We have a consensus forecast that we look at. It aggregates a bunch of economic forecasts. They have real GDP growth coming in at 1.8% for 2022 and only 0.2% for 2023. Once again, a lot of economists are seeing a recession in the future. If you go to the next page, this is Consumer Price Index, which is one of the biggest issues we've had right now is inflation. As you can see here, in the beginning of April of 21, our Consumer Price Index started to expand or go higher quite quickly. Usually, the Fed likes to keep inflation around 2%, and if you look past decade, that's where it's been for the most part. However, with high demand, healthy balance sheets in households from government support, we've seen an increase in demand for products and the prices associated with them are all going up. This has also led to an increase in wages, which also puts pressure on inflation. As you can see here, CPI reached a high of 9.1% in June of 2022. That's the blue line at the top where it's peaking, whereas core CPI, which excludes food and energy, topped out at 6.6% in September. The latest measurements in October had headline CPI at 7.7% and core CPI ticked down to 6.3%. So hopefully we're seeing a peak and maybe we'll start seeing some declines in inflation. There is a lot of other indicators showing that yes, we should see some lower prices in other areas. But expectation is for inflation to remain high into the new year and continue to decline, but we're going to see higher rates than that 2%. So on the next page, you see Treasury yield curves. To fight this overheating economy and a tight labor market, the Fed started raising interest rates, short-term interest rates. This was done to slow down the economy by slowing down how much the housing market does and slow down any interest-sensitive industries. As you can see at the beginning of the year, this is a yield curve. It shows Treasury yields from 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 2 year, 5 year, 7 year, 10 year, 20 year, and 30 year. At the beginning of the year, we had a pretty healthy-looking yield curve, basically lower rates for lower duration instruments. So if I'm going to lend you money for a month, I don't expect that much back. Whereas if I'm lending you money for 20 years, I want more money from that. So you expect higher rates. As the Fed started tightening monetary policy, these rates started going up. Basically, in March, they started with a quarter point, and then in May, a half point, and then we've had four successive three-quarter point raises of short-term interest rates. As you can see here, as the year went along, the rates all went up. However, we're starting to see an inversion of the yield curve. Now, an inversion of the yield curve is basically when short-term interest rates are higher than long-term interest rates. This is often an indicator of a recession in the near future. especially when the 2-year versus the 10-year gets inverted. So market expectations are for another half point increase at the next meeting, which is the middle of December. So the plan was for the Fed is trying to do is slow down the economy without putting it into a recession. This would be the soft landing. We slow down the economy, but we're hopefully not going to kill jobs as much. Now, we're probably going to lose some, but hopefully not throw into a full recession. So on the next page, 8, you can see the Purchasing Managers Index, or the PMI for the manufacturing sector. Basically, this is an index where the values over 50, that means expansion, below 50 is contraction. As you can see here, at the beginning of the pandemic, you saw contraction, and then as the economy opened up, we saw some all-time highs. However, since March of 21, where the U.S. PMI peaked, we've been steadily trending down. Now, some of this is related to the tightening of the Fed, some of it's not. Latest month was 50.2 as its measurement, and that's just barely some expansion. If you look at the Illinois one, we're down to 45.2, which would indicate contraction. So it's definitely slowing the economy in the manufacturing sector and maybe even some contraction in the Illinois market. However, if you look at the services PMI, which is the bigger portion of this economy, you can see a similar drop down during the initial stages of the pandemic. And then we reached an all-time high in November of 2021, and we've gone back down, but we're still in the mid-50s, which, if you look at prior to the pandemic, that's where it normally is. So we'll keep an eye on this because it is trending down, but at this point, it's still pretty in a pretty healthy spot.
Really quick on that, do you track that for Illinois as well on the services
side? No, there is okay. No... as far as I'm aware, there's not a services PMI.
Thank you.
Level. So on page 10, we see employment for the U.S. And this is one of the things that's been one of the strengths of this economy is a really tight market. We've been seeing job growth throughout the last 2 years. Depending on which survey you look at, either the household survey or the establishment survey, which looks at payrolls, we lost between 22 and 26 million jobs in April of 2020. Since that time, we basically have made up all those jobs on the establishment survey side. We're just barely below in the household survey side. One thing you'll notice is a much quicker rebound compared to the Great Recession. We basically made up all the jobs in about 30 months since the pandemic began versus about 76 months after the Great Recession. So far in 2022, we've added up almost 4.1 million jobs, or about 407,000 per month. However, as you'll see on the next slide, we've been slowing down the last few months. On page 11, you can see the monthly gains for the last year and a half or so. Since January of 2021 through February of this year, we added 569,000 jobs in the U.S. per month. At that point is when they started raising the rates. And as you can see from them, we've been slowing down ever since. Now, that's not all directly related to that. It takes longer than that to get the effects of short-term interest rates through the economy. But there is definitely some effect, and you can see that in the GDP numbers. Housing has been contracting since then. So over the last 3 months, we've only been adding 289,000 jobs. This sounds like a bad thing, but that is what the Fed intended. We want to slow down the market. Make it not quite as tight and line up job seekers with job openings. We have had some of the highest levels of job openings in history. The slowdown in jobs has mostly been seen in retail, trade, and transportation and warehousing, whereas overall strength has been seen in educational health services and professional and business services. Page 12 shows the Illinois employment situation, very similar, except we haven't rebounded quite as much. This is not really surprising. Illinois has lagged the country as a whole quite often when it goes through recessions and rebounds. Illinois lost between 769,000 and 895,000 jobs, depending on which survey you look at. And we've made up quite a bit of those, but we're still about 1% or 1.5% below where we were. about 62,000 to 117,000 jobs. So, if you look at the next page, you can look at the unemployment rates. Similar to what I said before, we've always sort of lagged the country as a whole in the last decade. If you look at the unemployment rates, Illinois is in red, and the U.S. is in blue. We've consistently been about a half point to a point higher in our unemployment rate throughout the last decade. We actually caught up and basically were even with the U.S. right before the pandemic hit. But unfortunately, when we spiked with the pandemic, it looks like that gap has returned. As of September, the U.S. unemployment rate was 3.5%, while Illinois was at 4.5%. So we're a full point higher than them. The U.S. actually rose to 3.7% in October. We don't have the numbers quite yet for Illinois. Looking at Illinois individually, two of the things we track closely is the number of jobs and the wages. This helps us forecast our income tax revenues. As you can see here, we had some significant growth in the number of jobs between fiscal year 2021 and 2022. Standing out is leisure and hospitality. Had over 20% growth, almost 94,000 jobs were added. However, even though we've had this significant growth, we're only at 549,000 jobs compared to what we were in fiscal year 2019. It was almost 621,000. So while we've made gains there, the employment makeup in the economy has changed some. Overall, jobs were up 4.1% in FY22. Looking at wages, we saw a similar growth of 4.1%. So if you took it, one of the main things when we do income tax receipts, forecasting is look at how many jobs do we get, about 4.1%, how much wages is in growth, about another 4.1%. You add those two together, you get about 8%, where if you look at income taxes, that's where we were. So we're doing well there compared to where we were previously, but we've also seen a slowdown in wages in recent months, which is actually a good thing, because one of the things we were worried about is a price wage spiral. You know, more things cost things, more people want money, and you just sort of go back and forth. And we're not really seeing that at this point. So that's where we are in the economy. The question is, where are we going? So looking at some economic forecasts on page 16, one of the forecasts we look at is consensus forecast. It's a forecast of about 25 banks and econometric firms, business associations, academic institutions, and individual businesses. As you can see on the top line, the real GDP estimate for 2022 is 1.8%. This is well below where we've seen in the 2021 was at 5.9%. However, 1.8% isn't that bad for real GDP looking in the long term. However, the forecast for 2023 is 0.2%. Once again, a lot of forecasters are predicting a recession in 2023. Consumer prices, they have coming at 8.1% in 2022 and then falling to 4.1%. So they see inflation falling, but it's not going back all the way to where we want it at 2%. I've seen some forecasts on a quarterly basis. At the end of 2023, we might be getting closer to 2 or 3%, but on the average for the whole year, they're thinking 4.1%. Finally, on page 17, one of the people we pay is IHS Market. They give some scenarios related to the economy, and they have a baseline scenario with a 55% chance of occurrence. Calls for tightening financial conditions to tip the U.S. economy into a mild recession from the fourth quarter of 2022 through the second quarter of next year. A more pessimistic scenario with a 30% probability has the recovery stumbling as the Russia-Ukraine conflict intensifies and drags on, leading to weaker consumer spending and a moderate recession. So those two scenarios basically call for some form of a recession at an 85% probability. So you can definitely see why there's some negativity. Now, that's mild to moderate, so it might not be that bad. Now, the final 15% likely optimistic scenario has continued a slowdown in economic growth, but a faster resolution of the Russia-Ukraine conflict and improving supply issues driving faster growth in the baseline scenario. The scenario also assumes more robust consumer and business response to the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Now what you'd see there, that'd be more the soft landing. That's what the Fed's aiming for. Basically, continued slowing of the economy, but not hitting a full-on recession. And that's what I have for my section. Now, Eric will talk to you about the economic forecast or the revenue forecast we made.
Good morning. Let me get a little closer to the mic. We're going to start on page 19. We're going to look at the general fund's revenue final budget assumptions, the revenues that were assumed for the budget. You see at the bottom of this page, a total of $46.4 billion was assumed for this year's budget. Now, there's a couple lines that I want to point out at the very beginning here, because I'm going to be referring back to these several times throughout this presentation. One of those is in the transfers in line. You have income tax refund fund transfer in. You can see here that we had $200 million put in for that line. What that is money that's collected from income tax revenues. There's a portion of that is set aside to pay for refund funds. At the end of the fiscal year, if there is a balance, and typically there is, that money is then transferred to the state's general funds the next fiscal year. Again, only $200 million was assumed, and that's very similar to what we've had in the past. I will be coming back to that later in the presentation. The other thing I want to point out is at the very bottom here, we have a line called the ARPA reimbursement for essential government services. This is the amount of money that the federal government was giving states to reimburse them for expenses related to the pandemic. $1.5 billion was assumed to come from that. This is a number that GOMB had predicted. All of that money was expected to come into fiscal year 22, be receipted in fiscal year 22, and that's why you're seeing that as zero in fiscal year 23. But as I'll be talking about here shortly, we did have some of that money trickle into fiscal year 23. So if we go on to the next page, on page 20, this is more of a summary table of everything together. Again, the assumed revenue total for the fiscal year 23 budget is $46.4 billion. We had higher than expected revenues collected over the last quarter of fiscal year 22. This helped elevate our final total in fiscal year 22 to be a little over $51 billion, which is a record high. Therefore, the fiscal year 23 enacted budget is actually $4.6 billion lower than fiscal year 22 actuals. In other words, we could drop $4.6 billion in fiscal year 23 and still reach the budget that we had assumed for. So how are we doing? Well, instead of the $4.6 billion decline, or any kind of decline, we've actually had just the opposite so far in fiscal year 23. Looking at the chart on page 21, we show the performance on a monthly month basis for general fund performance. We show it in three different formats. The blue would show how we're performing on a state sources basis. The white would include federal sources, what we call the base federal sources numbers or revenues that we have coming in. And the gray would include any one-time revenues that we receive, such as the ARPA reimbursement money. You can see in July, in total, we had $395 million more in this July than we had the previous July. In August, we drew another $435 million. September, another $194 million. In October, we had a very good, very strong month, up another $643 million. So combined, for the first 4 months of the fiscal year, we are actually up nearly $1.7 billion in growth. On page 22, you can see a breakdown of where we're seeing this growth. A lot of this growth is coming from what we call the big three: personal income tax, corporate income tax, and sales tax. And these were the same drivers of the revenue growth that we saw in fiscal year 22. Personal income tax, through the first 4 months, are up 11.1%, or $790 million on a gross basis. But when you subtract out the money set aside for the refund fund and local government distributive fund, that amount falls a little bit to $666 million. Despite market conditions, corporate income tax receipts have done quite well. They've grown $294 million, or 18.3% on a gross basis, or $242 million on a net basis. Sales tax receipts have continued to stay strong, even though they're not at the same pace that they were in fiscal year 22, but they are still up $274 million gross, or $145 million when you subtract out the money set aside for the road fund and other transportation funds. That's still a growth of 4.2%. All other state sources have combined, they have a mixed bag, but they've continued to grow $87 million. Now, a lot of this is led by a $68 million increase in interest income due to the significantly higher interest rates that we have seen from the federal government. You can see at this point last year, We had only $4 million come from this interest income through the first 4 months. We are already up to $72 million through October in fiscal year 23. The state transfers in line, collectively, we're up $252 million. You'll see the vast majority of that comes from this income tax refund fund transfer that I mentioned to you earlier. This total is $493 million so far in fiscal year 23. Last year at this point, we had only $242 million, and that was the final number for fiscal year 22. In fact, this $493 million is just a beginning to what we're going to see at the remainder of fiscal year 23, as there was a huge increase in the amount of transfer for this fund, and we'll be talking about that shortly. Base federal sources, they're actually down $345 million, but if you include the ARPA reimbursement money, we had some money that ended up falling into fiscal year 23, had receipts come in July and August. We have received that exact amount, the $1.5 billion that was originally expected. However, it's the timing when we have received that. We have received $764 million in 23 that was expected to be in 22, but that's a boost to the 23 revenues. So on page 23, this is just a summary table of the major components of this, again showing the $1.7 billion increase that we have so far this fiscal year. So, because of the strong growth that we have seen so far, this is positive factors for increasing our fiscal year 23 revenue outlook. As compared to fiscal year 22 actuals, and I'm on page 24, fiscal year 23 began the year able to absorb a $4.6 billion fall off in order to reach the enacted budget. Therefore, given the year-to-date growth of nearly $1.7 billion, revenues would have to fall $6.3 billion over the last two-thirds of the fiscal year just to reach our budgetary level. This level of fall-off is not likely. So therefore, we're going to be increasing our revenue outlook for fiscal year 23. Inflation, while it is indeed a concern, especially in the long term, in the short term, it actually can help increase revenues. If you have a higher prices and people continue to spend on these higher prices, you're going to have additional sales tax revenues, and that's what we have seen this fiscal year and last fiscal year. This pressure with the higher prices has resulted in increased wages. Higher wages results in higher income tax revenues, so we're seeing that as well. And then again, as I mentioned earlier, we have interest income growing because of the higher interest rates. All these factors related to inflation are actually helping income or helping tax revenues this fiscal year so far, leading to us to increase our outlook for fiscal year 23. And again, going back to the income tax refund transfer, we've had $493 million come in so far. That amount will grow to nearly $1.5 billion by the end of this fiscal year. Again, we only had $200 million that was assumed for this amount. And so this is an upward adjustment in this fund of $1.281 billion. So very good news for fiscal year 23, but this is not something that can be counted on in the future. Again, going back to the ARPA reimbursement, again, we had zero money set aside for that, so this is another upward pressure for our revenue estimate of $764 million. So on page 25, look at our revenue estimate. You will see that we are increasing our fiscal year 23 revenue outlook by $4.9 billion due to the reasons that we are discussing that I've just discussed. I want to note that this value is only $259 million above the fiscal year 22 final level. Personal income tax on a net basis, we're increasing our estimate by nearly $1.6 billion. Corporate income tax up $633 million on a net basis. Sales tax revenues up $336 million. All other state sources, we're increasing at $204 million. Again, a lot of that has to do with the interest income increase. Transfers in, $1.364 billion, again, because of the increase in that refund fund transfer. Federal sources, we're going to leave alone right now, even though they're running behind just slightly right now, but we're going to just leave that at $4 billion at the time being. And again, you see the $764 million increase in the ARPA reimbursement, this one-time revenue stream, bringing the total increase again to $4.9 billion. So you will note on that table that from the personal income tax, our revised estimate is $24.2 billion. That's still below where we were last year. So even though we're doing a huge increase, I just want to note that it's still below. So we're still taking a very conservative look, even though personal income taxes are growing 10% so far this fiscal year. Corporate income tax revenues are up 19% for this fiscal year, but yet our revised estimate remains below where fiscal year 22 was. So we're expecting a slowdown to occur. Sales tax revenues were only just slightly above where fiscal year 22 levels landed. So I point this out because there are reasons for why we need to be conservative going forward, because there's a lot of uncertainty still exists. I want to go to, page 26 is more detail of what I just shared. But let's go to page 27. Reasons for us to, factors we need to consider going forward. Why is there so much uncertainty? Different possibilities. One, of course, COVID-19. Unfortunately, it is still out there. While it seems less and less likely that we'll have a resurgence, that possibly exists, and we have seen what a COVID-19 can do to the nation's economy. Unstable geopolitical environment, Ben mentioned that earlier. Ukraine-Russia conflict, we don't know how long that's going to last, and what kind of impact will that have on the trade between countries. World economies are struggling. We're not the only country that's dealing with inflation. If other countries struggle and there's job losses there, there could be problems in trade back and forth between countries, and this could affect Illinois and our job market. The inflation impacts. We are concerned with these federal rate hikes. Is this going to just slow things down, or we have major job losses? Something we're going to have to keep tracking, and another reason to be conservative in our fiscal year 23 revenue outlook. Recession. Are we entering a recession? How severe will it be? And the ultimate question is, when are we going to start to see this impact in revenues? Because we have not seen it yet. Our outlook is, again, very conservative, because we think that there is concerns that we are going to see some turnaround here shortly. But when, still something we're still trying to question. Page 28, you can see that we're starting to see a little slowdown. This is sales tax revenues, the four-month moving average of year-over-year growth. You can see that we were doing really well in 2021, but things have slowed down quite a bit here in 2022. The reasons for this weakening is weaker consumer confidence, purchasing power erosion due to inflation. We have higher motor fuel prices still, and so if people are spending more money on motor fuel, they're probably spending less money on other areas. This can impact sales tax. Returning shift from taxable goods to non-taxable service sectors. During the pandemic, there was a lot of goods being purchased because of the extra money that people have with stimulus money. Now that they've purchased those big things, now that they have done those house remodels, there's probably not as much goods to be purchased going forward. So there should be a slowdown in sales tax revenues from that. There's no additional federal stimulus available that is assumed and going forward to help boost spending. And the higher interest rates that's been going on, it probably means fewer houses being sold. That means fewer big item purchases, such as new furniture or new appliances and stuff like that. So there's reasons for why we're seeing a slowdown, and we think that this slowdown will probably continue. I do want to note, though, at the end of these graphs here, September and October, we're still seeing a plus 5% growth. In a typical year, that would be very good. We'd be very pleased with that. It's this downward trend is what we're concerned about going forward. And finally, on page 29, you see income tax revenue graph. What this does is show the income increase, the month year-over-year growth of employment and wages stacked together. And Ben discussed that earlier. We've seen significant growth in income tax revenues over the last fiscal year, especially in our withholding, near 8%. That's because of the increase we've had in wages and the increase we've had in employment. But as that starts to slow down, and as you can see in this table, it's starting to slow down, and the question is, will this continue? There's also concern going forward of what final tax payments are going to look like in the second half of this fiscal year. As you know, tax year 21 was especially strong, and that resulted in really high final tax payments from corporate profits, from capital gains. Market conditions have not been so good in tax year 2022, which should result in a slowdown in revenues from the final payments in fiscal year 23. So these are reasons for why we are being conservative going forward. Now on page 30, you will see how our estimates compare to GOMB. They released their November revision just yesterday afternoon. you can see that their bottom line number is around $50.1 billion compared to our $51.3. So they are a little lower than us. They are in growing their estimate by $3.69 billion, where we are up $4.9 billion. So we're a little higher than them by $1.2 billion. You can see the differences between our estimates. We're pretty close in most of the areas, but we are a little more aggressive. And I say aggressive, we're probably just a tiny bit less conservative than them in personal income tax rates. But I say that, but just to reach our number, to give you some context, we would have to fall 7.1% in personal income tax the remainder of the year just to reach our estimate. They would have to fall nearly 12.2%. So I feel very comfortable with the numbers we're putting. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if we have to do an upward revision in March when we come back at that time. So the bottom line is this, and I'll just wrap up in a summary statement here. In summary, the revenue outlook for fiscal year 23 looks promising. The growth that we have seen through the first third of the year, coupled with the influx of revenues from the income tax refund fund transfer and from ARPA reimbursement, has prompted this $4.9 billion increase in the Commission's fiscal year 23 revenue outlook. Despite this sizable increase, the Commission is confident that these revenue projections are very, very realistic, given the calculated falloff that would be needed just to hit the Commission's revised figures. In fact, it is possible, if not likely, that the Commission will follow up with an additional increase in March, if any semblance of the current pace of revenue growth continues. The revised estimate assumes a cautious approach to the remainder of the year due to the number of uncertainties that remain, especially as it relates to inflation, employment levels, and the nation's economy. As the months progress, it appears more than likely that the brunt of the impact of a potential recession in Illinois will be on fiscal year 24. While a fiscal year 24 revenue projection is not being offered at this time, the outlook is concerning. The factors providing the fiscal year 23 growth, such as the ARPA reimbursement dollars, the higher than typical transfers from the refund fund, and employment growth will almost certainly not be available in fiscal year 2024. In other words, the revenue surplus we are enjoying will likely be short-lived. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions? Go ahead, Senator Severson.
So a couple questions, not in any particular order. I noticed when we look at the economic growth, even though income taxes are up, I think I had a report that the personal debt from the Fed said personal debt had grown to another $400 or $500 billion to some number in the trillions, which will that have a bigger impact when that slower economy comes and that you have that much personal debt out there? Is that going to have a bigger impact on the potential compounding of those recessionary issues?
I mean, definitely. The more debt we have, there's going to be issues. But right now, looking at like household debt, we're in a very strong position. We paid off a lot of debt during the initial phases of the pandemic, and we got a lot of government support. So compared to like where we were before the Great Recession, household finances are in a much better position. Now, we're starting to see some deterioration at the lower income levels, and they're spending down some of their savings. But so far, we've seen a slowdown in consumer spending, not a total fall off. So,
you say a personal, even despite the market collapse and the amount of personal debt from credit card debt that skyrocketed, that households are better off
financially
now?
If you look at like credit card debt, we're actually seeing a more of a return to where we were prior. It definitely has increased, but I think it's more of a return to where we were versus a somehow higher level than where we were on trend to before the pandemic. I would consider our finances as a country pretty good right now. A lot of people have locked in their equity in their houses, and there's much more equity obtained, and people have financed at 2 or 3, 4%, whereas now before the pandemic or during the Great Recession, there just wasn't that back support or foundation that they have. So I think you won't be seeing quite as much
like the bankruptcies and stuff like that. I don't think that would be in the cards in the near future.
The other question would be is the normally the Feds raise interest rates to try to slow the economy down, but are the Feds fighting against themselves with this continued printing of money, which was the real driver, I think, of this inflationary rate? You can't print trillions of dollars and not think that that dollar is not worth it.
Yes. So the Fed's doing multiple things. They're had a program to rebalance their balance sheet. They were bringing their balance sheet more in order and decreasing it. However, they're starting to have some issues with rolling their debt over. Basically, there are some issues with the amount of that, and there is a questions of how the balance sheet side at the Fed level will affect this, but it's somewhat unknown at the moment. And definitely, the interest rate increases we've seen are historically high compared to what we've seen previously. I mean, usually, we're doing more a quarter point, maybe a half point. We've seen 4 3-quarter points. And that's one of the big questions right now. Are we going to see a sort of a pivot? Like I said, the market condition or market expectations are for a slowdown to a half a point increase. I've seen some people think there are going to be maybe 2 to 3 more increases, and then hopefully you get ahead of inflation and it'll be able to slow down. However, every time we start getting a good inflation number, as you might have seen last week, the market starts loosening up itself and sort of fighting the Fed. You know, they start offering lower rates, and then all of a sudden you get more economic activity. Well, the Fed wants to see multiple months in a row of good inflation numbers. Now, we did see the good CPI the other day. This morning they released some producer's price index that was lower than expected. So there are some indications that inflation is potentially being under control, but the problem is the market doesn't help sometimes, and they started to get ahead of the Fed, and they'd like to see more consistent a couple months in a row before they really start pivoting to looser policy again.
I guess it depends on what they included in inflation. Anyone that's gone shopping or filled up their gas tank knows that, or purchased health care, realize that the inflation is not slowing down, which is really crippling families. So if we move into a recessionary time, those pressures aren't going to decrease. You know, your cost of goods, energy costs are going to continue to skyrocket, and health care costs for families is going to continue to skyrocket. So that eats up a lot of that, I think, income that we've seen.
Oh, definitely.
Raised. So, okay, thank you. I appreciate your time and giving us reports today.
Any other questions from the members? I just want to reiterate what you said earlier about this being, much of this being short-term positive. You know, it's always good to have the positive, but it's short-term positive, and I think we need to start planning for maybe behind the eight ball on planning for a possible recession, but better now than never. So I appreciate that. Thank you. And now I will... we'll go ahead and turn it over to Senator Kaler to handle the health insurance side.
Thank you, Andrew. We're going to hear from our first panel, which is CMS. While they're coming up, let me just mention that the changes that we're going to discuss this morning have caused some questions amongst a lot of people in Illinois, and so along with Representative Davidsmeyer, myself, and Clayton, we felt that it would be good to have a subject matter hearing on this just to make sure that we have all the information out there and can answer questions that people have on their minds. So I would ask the first panel to please introduce yourselves and proceed. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you, Co-Chair Kaler and Co-Chair Davidsmeyer, and members of the Commission. I am pleased to join you today. My name is Anthony Piceni, and I am the Acting Director of the Department of Central Management Services. Joining me today are Carrie Wolf, Deputy Director of CMS's Bureau of Benefits, and Colin Brewer, the Bureau's Chief Financial Officer. As you are aware, one mission of the department is to provide high-quality, affordable health insurance coverage to retirees of the state of Illinois, the teachers' retirement system, and the community colleges. In an effort to achieve that mission, and in accordance with the Illinois Procurement Code, the Bureau of Benefits issued a request for proposal seeking a vendor to provide coverage to our Medicare-eligible retirees and their dependents in the Medicare Advantage Prescription Drug Program, otherwise known as MAPD. The current MAPD contract will expire on December 31st, 2022. The RFP allowed for the award of one PPO plan and multiple HMO plans. After a complete and thorough review of all responses to the RFP, the department awarded a single PPO contract to Aetna Life Insurance Company. No HMO contracts were awarded. The decision to only award a PPO plan was based on multiple factors that we believe are in the best interest of the state, as well as our MAPD enrollees, including approximately 90% of all MAPD enrollees are currently enrolled in the PPO plan, as it allows the member the most flexibility to seek provider care. Significant cost savings to both the state and members resulted from the guaranteed $0 premium available only through the PPO plan. Establishment of a wellness fund that will allow the state to continue to provide programs beyond the services provided to members through the health plan. And finally, the highly regarded and valued Silver Sneakers program would not have been available in the future under the current PPO vendor. As a result, the department made the decision to award only the PPO plan. We understand that prior to the completion of the procurement, there was inaccurate and incomplete information reported to the public that increased the anxiety and concerns of our retired enrollees. As soon as allowable under the procurement code, our office began providing accurate plan details, and we will continue to do so through ongoing communication to plan members, as well as seminars that are currently being held through November 18th. At this time, I would like to thank you for your support over the last year, and I look forward to working with members of the commission as we continue to provide high-quality, affordable health insurance to the state of Illinois retirees. We are happy to answer any questions at this time.
Any questions from the members of Senator Rose?
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to participate, as it's largely my constituents who have been impacted by this decision negatively. And will CMS be prepared to testify later after everyone else has testified? Because I think we're going to hear quite a bit of the problems.
We're going to right before we have public comments, we're going to ask CMS and Aetna to come back and answer some of the questions.
Okay. So first of all, I'd like to introduce my constituents in the back of the room, Bill and Marty Alanya, and they're prepared to testify later today. Mr. Alanya is currently on the transplant list at Barnes Hospital. Barnes Hospital doesn't take Aetna. Come January 1st, he's off that list. So I find it curious when you say that you're providing high-quality access to care, how you can unleash a plan that not only leaves Mr. Alanya twisting in the wind, but when it was initially announced, left most of my constituents without access to the main provider of access in all of East Central Illinois, which is Carle Hospital. So at what point in time did you know, CMS, that Carle Hospital was not in this plan?
So I think it's important to describe the type of network that is available through this plan. It is a passive PPO plan, which is what we currently have under the current PPO vendor. It allows members to see services from both providers that are in network, which means contracted with Aetna, and providers that are out of network, meaning that that provider is willing to bill Aetna or whoever the Medicare Advantage plan happens to be for the charges and be reimbursed. At the time the contract was awarded, Carle Hospital and their clinics were billing the current PPO vendor, and we had no indication at that time that anything would change.
Let me stop you right there. You're telling me that CMS didn't have multiple communications from my office since as early as a year ago about the problems between Carl and Aetna?
That was not regarding the PPO plan. That was regarding
it was regarding the I know that.
Plan.
But right. So you know that Carl dropped Aetna from their HMO. You knew that a year ago, which, by the way, you fought me on that a year ago. And let me take a step back. I want to say this publicly about Aetna. I have no issue with Aetna. I think Aetna is going to be a fine provider for quite a few people, okay? In fact, Larry from their office has gone above and beyond over the last year to help my constituents navigate Carl dropping Aetna the first time. He hasn't always been able to help, but he's made a sincere effort to help the people who have been left behind. So this isn't about Aetna, okay? But you guys knew a year ago that Aetna had been dropped from Carl on their HMO product. In fact, the funny part about that was, at one point in time, you guys even told me that that wasn't true, despite Channel 3 having done an entire story about the fact that they've been dropped. You guys then had the unmitigated audacity and temerity to tell me that wasn't true. That's interesting. Channel 3 says it's true. Maybe Channel 3's lying. So I called Aetna. I said, Larry, CMS is telling me that you guys are still with Carl in this HMO. Is that true? Even Aetna says, no, that's not true. And I called you back and I said, Aetna says this isn't true. And oh, no, it's true. They can go wherever they want. You guys are amazing in the amount of disreality. And by the way, sir, I don't know who you are, interim director of such and such, but to sit here and say unreliable information, do you know who the number one purveyor of unreliable information is? It's someone who sends out a fact that says, if the provider is willing to take Aetna, if, operative word, if, you unleashed a disaster on my constituents, scared the living bejesus out of them, and you come in here and tell me unreliable information, you've known for a year, that there were problems here. Now, let's go back to positive. Why do we only have one choice? Because this isn't about what's happened. Well, it is actually, because Mr. Alanya still doesn't have access to health care. And by the way, he's not alone. In the last 2 days, I have another constituent in my district who's on the kidney transplant list, and guess what? She doesn't take Aetna either. So let's get back to positive. What are we going to do to offer actual choice to these people who work for the state of Illinois their entire lives? And by the way, the deal was free. Not premiums, not copays. The deal was free. Okay? And now you don't even have access. By the way, I think in a minute, Linda Brookhart's going to talk about that Aetna has a huge problem in the state of Florida. So those retirees have no access. Snowbirds have no access. So what are we going to do about giving people choice? And don't you dare tell me you didn't know. Any of you.
So I will say when we went through, we had quite a few conversations when we were deciding the award for this RFP. In doing that, we have to look at not only the state of Illinois retirees, we have to look at the retirees that are under our teachers program, and also the retirees that are under our community college program. Over between the three programs that we have, as the director previously said, over approximately 90% of our enrollees are already in the passive PPO plan that we have. Looking at that and the fact that the premium was locked in at a $0 premium for the first five years of the contract, and that the provider disruption was very minimal, and that there was only a 1.09% disruption in provider billing, meaning that those providers that were currently billing the PPO plan were within the Aetna extended service area network, and the fact that all of the HMOs came in with a significant dollar amount premium, After the best and final offers, all HMOs came in with a premium ranging anywhere from $77 a month to $144 a month. In looking at that and the difference between the cost share and the copay and things like that, the decision was made to award to only the PPO company.
Okay, so you didn't answer the question, but let me rephrase it.
Let me ask a question on that. So how do we deal with the situation that Senator Rose has articulated? What happens with people when they're caught kind of in this transition and don't know where to go? How do we deal with it?
What has happened is Aetna has worked very closely and diligently with Carl Clinic and Carl Hospital in Camden County. They have come to an agreement. They are in the process of finalizing their contract. It should be finally signed by the end of the year, prior to January 1st, when all of these individuals will roll into the Aetna plan. With the situation of the, I'm assuming the transplant facility you're speaking of is Barnes Jewish in St. Louis. Aetna has already spoken to Barnes regarding an agreement to bill for these services. Unfortunately, because of HIPAA, and they are not able to discuss with Barnes individual patient cases because of the fact that it would be a violation of their medical rights. And until Aetna receives the enrollment for each one of these patients, then they can't have a conversation of a case-by-case agreement.
Even if it's the insurance company that's covering the patient?
They are not covering the patient until January 1st.
And I would point out, Mr. Chairman, that the contract was issued. I mean, they've already spoken to them. When's the deadline for this to sign up?
November 30th.
Yeah, and November 30th.
Aetna is handling every constituent, every member that contacts their office that is in this type of situation or any other situation regarding transition of care. And Aetna will be able to speak more to the transition of care policies and the conversations that they've had with the providers. They are working to ensure that there is a smooth transition.
So my issue isn't with Aetna. In fact, they're going to have very few questions asked. It's with you guys, what you just said. You issued a contract to someone who didn't have access to care. Okay? And Mr. Alanya has to make a decision sometime in the next 15 days to go somewhere else, pick a different plan, pay out of pocket. You guys, have you heard the Kinnerva opinion, Illinois Supreme Court, 7-0, unanimous? Yeah. Okay. If this isn't a diminishment in contract benefit bargain, what is? And here it is, by the way. Here's an email from December 7th of 2021. Here's from Aetna. Aetna even says your healthcare provider will no longer be in network. And you guys kept saying, you guys have known the whole time. And yes, I'm glad Carl, it took a month, and they still haven't signed the deal. But members of the panel, I think in a minute you're going to hear from Linda Burkhardt as well, that the formulary still isn't out. So people today are being forced to make decisions about whether they're going to stay with Aetna or go buy some other Medicare Advantage plan somewhere else, which, by the way, is probably what this is really about. And they're having to do it without even knowing what they're going to pay for their copays and what of their medicines are in-network and what of their medicines are out-of-network. So let's get back to the question I asked. What are we going to do about offering these people choice?
I mean, at this time, I think we would like to proceed with the, you know, the PPO plan as is. You know, we are happy to work with you to discuss other options, but we do believe the merits of the program and our decision will reveal itself.
Okay, this is the last thing I'm going to say for this panel. I will be happy to work with you any day of the week. I have been trying to work with you for over a year. I'm sorry, 11 and a half months. You guys have refused to work with me, Representative Marin, the rest of us. So if you're going to be serious about saying that, it better not be right here in front of COGFA when your ass is on the line.
So I take it that that is an invitation for Senator Rose to work with you on this. And I think that's the issue that that we have, is that what happens to people that are caught in a bind, no fault of their own, and just some assurance that this will be worked out. I mean, this going into the end of the enrollment period with some uncertainties in terms of what the coverage is really going to be is not very satisfying. So if we can make the point. Senator, Representative Davidsmeyer?
Yeah, and I just want to say, you mentioned we'll talk about other options, but it seems like we've decided that the PPO is the only option, correct?
Correct. We awarded the PPO plan without the HMO.
Okay. So you've already said, you know, we'll talk about options, but this is the option. Got the option of this or nothing, correct?
We would like to see the current PPO plan roll out, and then we certainly could discuss other options, but we believe the merits of the program will reveal itself
so
in the coming months.
The answer is yes, the PPO is the option. Representative Marin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. thank you for being here today and being willing to answer questions. I just have a few procedural questions on how this process works. So what actually governs the RFP process? Is this set out in the state procurement code? Exactly how is this process governed?
Yes, the current contract is coming up at its 10-year life. The Illinois procurement code only allows contracts for 10 years, so we were required by state law to issue a new RFP for these services.
So when companies submit RFPs, then is there a scoring process? How does that work? Is that process open to the public?
The process is not open up to the public in terms of submitting a bid or...
Well, excuse me, let me clarify. So does the public have any input? And then also, as far as... does the public have input on the process? Do you take input from people that this will potentially affect?
The public does not have input into the process. We develop a scoring tool that looks at a variety of factors, basically a technical proposal as well as the pricing proposal. The technical can include, you know, such factors as customer service, quality of care, what other factors? Communications, being able to access people through a hotline, so a variety of factors that were taken into consideration.
Is the scoring process, is that available to the public if the public were to ask for what are the criteria that are in place that you're making this judgment call on?
When the RFP is issued, scoring factors are listed.
Okay. Is there any, I guess, analysis done? For instance, the Aetna PPO plan may be the best plan, the best fit statewide. Is there any drill down analysis on how this impacts different regions of the state? For instance, I represent an area that has a very large population of retirees that are impacted because the major health care provider previously to this did not have an agreement with Aetna. Is there any regional drill down analysis done to that effect in the process?
No, there is not.
Would you be open to those changes, whether that's legislatively? Is that something that we could explore in the future so that we could avoid problems like this?
Yes, we could certainly explore those options.
Okay, and the only other question I had, so you have the scoring process and you have the options on the table. You had the PPO option. You had potential other HMO options. What criteria is then used for that final decision to say, okay, we're only going with the PPO. We're not going to put any other options, any other available options on the table for consumers. I mean, what is that decision-making process? Is that just the call of the director? What precludes you from saying we're going to put option A, option B on the table? And is it a mechanism of scoring? Is it a judgment call? Kind of explain that to me, please.
Yeah, so the RFP was determining best value, so both the technical and the pricing proposal. As previously mentioned, the PPO offered a $0 premium. The HMO premiums range from anywhere from $77 to, or to say approximately $80 a month premium. With having over 90% of the current enrollees in a PPO plan, you know, typically people look at an HMO for affordability, PPO plan for flexibility. When we have a PPO plan that was awarded at $0 premium, that removes the affordability aspect. So in a sense, you're getting the best of both worlds. We're having the maximum flexibility with a zero premium.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering my questions. I would like to continue these conversations. I think there's room for improvement in the process to make sure that situations like this don't occur in the future. I understand that's your argument. I personally believe, and I think we maybe need to explore the option of being able to put more products on the table. So I would like to continue that conversation in the future. Thank you.
Representative Ellick.
It sounds as though that many people are being asked to make a decision during open enrollment period without all the available information. Is there any likelihood or chance that that open enrollment period can be extended for a week, 2 weeks, 30 days, anything to help people in these situations?
Unfortunately, no. because of the fact it is a Medicare product, we have to end the open enrollment by the time that federal Medicare enrollment ends. It would give an additional 6 days federal Medicare open enrollment ends on the first. But I would like to also say that we have been working diligently throughout the months of November through all of the open enrollment periods to provide individuals with all of the information regarding the plan, getting their questions answered, things of that nature. We have held before open enrollment started, we held 3 virtual webinars for people to attend. We had approximately 2,000 members that attended those 3 seminars. We have also every work day that we have had in the month of November, we have had seminars in person where people could actually come speak to someone from Aetna, hear about the plan, get questions answered. They've had clinical people available to answer any questions regarding if someone has something regarding their individual health need that couldn't be brought up during the presentation. We, as of the completion of our seminars yesterday, we have had approximately 6,000 attendees at the ones that we have had. We have 8 seminars left. We have 2 this evening in Champaign and 1 tomorrow in Champaign. And then we have also added, working with Senator Rose's office, we have added an additional seminar on November 21st. I do not have the details of it yet. It will be at Eastern Illinois University. We are still working with them to finalize the event itself, but to address that population if they were not able to travel to one of the other cities that were in that area.
So there are obviously those some people with serious medical concerns that don't have all the information available to them about what their coverage is going to be as far as people on a transplant list. You're still contracting with providers, or Aetna is still contracting with providers.
They are, and they are working also. Like I had said earlier, this is what we call a passive PPO, which is allowing them to see in or out of network providers. If the provider is willing to bill Aetna, even if the provider is not willing to bill Aetna, the member can seek reimbursement and file a claim for any services to Aetna themselves.
That sounds very difficult, time-consuming, and something that a person who's dealing with serious medical issues will not be able to do.
And we completely understand that. We are encouraging at each one of the seminars, if you have an individual health condition that you are concerned that your provider may not be available in network or may not, you know, plan, you know, that you ask those questions of the individual clinician people that are asking you to get a response to that. Aetna is very willing to work and contact any provider that they need to contact to, if they can't establish an agreement, to establish a case for case.
Thank you.
I think what's important, I mean, I have no doubt that 90-95% of the people will have a seamless transition, and they're in areas where they have adequacy of network and all that, but I think that what you're hearing is that for those who don't, how do we, you know, hold harmless their situation? And, you know, I'm wondering if there's, and it will, I'll ask this question of Aetna, if there's going to be navigators or somebody to help those individual patients really navigate that, because this is overwhelming. Any other questions for this panel? Senator Severson.
So just a couple questions. The first, you talked earlier about some of the bids that came in with the for an HMO, for example, that they had a $77 range. Were there in the offers, were the benefits that are being offered to the individuals, were they the same under all plans, or were there different benefits that these different plans, what was something offered in that $77 plan that wasn't in the $0 Aetna?
So HMOs, as you are aware, work differently in that they don't have a co-insurance type situation, they have a co-payment type situation. So, but we did not change the plan design. The plan designs that are currently in place were the plan designs that were put out in the RFP.
So the co-insurance amounts currently and the co-pays and the out-of-pocket maximums, those are the same now
they
as they were in the other ones?
Yes. Yeah, the co-pays for the co-payments for the HMOs, the plan design is, I forget what the office visit is, but of course, there's no deductible under an HMO, but the out-of-pocket maximum under an HMO is $3,000, whereas the out-of-pocket maximum under the PPO plan is either $1,100 for a state-of-Illinois employee, or for a teacher, or a college, or $1,300.
And does that include prescription out-of-pocket, or a prescription is a different scenario?
Prescriptions are a different scenario because of Medicare rules with the donut hole. And
so this is a normal Part D typical prescription plan.
Mm-hmm.
With is the formulary the same between what was under the current plan versus what the new plan is going to be? Or is that formulary, I'm guessing, is going to be different as well?
The formulary will be different because the prescription benefit manager is changing.
Okay. So those who are, that's potentially a problem too, again, for those who are high-end specialty drug users, that could be significant for them. Are they aware of that, or is there a prescription drug navigator that can work with those who are, I mean, because we're talking about potentially, I mean, thousands of dollars difference for different drugs if they're, what level they are on the formulary. Between the two, so knowing that's different, is there a way that an individual can model what drugs they're taking now under current plan versus what Aetna is doing?
Right. So one of the things that we have asked Aetna to do is to work. They are working to get lists of the prescriptions that members are currently taking to ensure if it is a prescription that needs a prior authorization, that they can begin to address that January 1st, and their, you know, members will automatically get an additional 30-day bill regardless, and then they'll have that additional 30 days.
Is there a website? Is there a Part D website that you could go to and plug in your drug, and it'll tell you what the potential cost is going to be?
It has a website. That it is stateofillinois.aetnamedicare.com, and you can look up either your pharmacies or your physician, or
but you can you run your model?
Your medicine, I'm not.
Yeah,
they'll be able to confirm
it. All right, can you run your normal model? I mean, that's, I mean, there's regular websites out there you can run at least people like I can access all the plans and what their co-pays are, but I think if that was out there, that could help alleviate some pain.
Right. There is also, they provide navigation assistance for those individuals that do have higher end drugs or have questions if they have a certain medication that's going to change a tier. They, if you contact their office, they have individuals there.
And you preferred, is there a different formulary for CVS versus other, is there other providers besides CVS as being the preferred provider? Do you know, or we can ask them?
Within the network,
yes.
The pharmacies, there are thousands.
But do they pay the same as what the CVS network does?
I mean, the copay is the copay. That is all the member will pay out of pocket. The formulary is devised by CVS where the drug falls. So, because they are the prescription benefit manager. So regardless of where you get your prescription drugs.
I don't think that's quite correct.
Well, I'll let them explain it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they are the
I don't think in the formularies it works that way. But on the disruptive report, I know you had mentioned that it's a small number. So, but I just want to clarify, make sure everyone understands, under a passive PPO, an individual can go to any doctor that accepts Medicare, and they may not bill for you, but you would still be covered. You just may have to manually submit that claim. Is that
correct?
So under federal law, if a doctor accepts Medicare for one, they have to accept it for everybody, but they may not bill for you. But in those cases where, whether it's Florida or some other area, if there's not a provider and they go to that, they go to any provider, they will be covered ultimately for medical services the same. They just may have to manually submit that bill if that provider won't do that for them. Is that correct?
Yes.
Whether it's a medical provider or a supply, whether it's the company that's delivering their oxygen or their wheelchairs or any other services, as long as they accept Medicare, they will take this product.
I'm going to let them explain it. It's how a little better how it works, because I'm not sure. I am not positive what the out-of-pocket expense would be ultimately for the member if that were the case. So I'm going to let Aetna explain that because they handle that.
And then last question. You talked about working with some of these other members about some alternatives, but this is a five-year contract, right? Is it a five-year contract?
It is a 5 and 5.
Okay, so no changes can be made for the first 5 years under this contract. So it really doesn't serve any good to have them meet to talk about plan changes because we can't really do anything for 5 years.
We cannot change this plan.
You can't bring in a secondary plan most likely either. I'm sure you're locked into a single 5-year contract with a single carrier. You can't bring in you can't create a dual choice or do anything else at this point. That 5-year.
Not for this plan year, no.
Not for the next 5 years. Right, you got to lock in 5-year contract. You can't make any changes for 5 years. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so just so it's clear from your standpoint, there is no negotiating of changes that can be taking place for 5 years. At that point, you can negotiate dual choices or different plans or what you want to do. But this is a 5-year.
I believe, though, if we do a new procurement, you could do.
Not within 5 years. After 5 years, you can do a new procurement.
We can do a procurement at any time. Not for this type of product.
Now you're getting confused.
You can do an HMO.
You're allowed to add another product. So in your contractual agreement, you can add another product in the future and not have it disrupt the contractual
agreement that you have with Aetna for 5 years?
So just two things. One, in terms of PPO, all of our contracts have termination for convenience clauses. So if we did want to issue a new PPO, that would be an option. But I think what some of the members were speaking of were an HMO plan, if we would consider adding that as another option.
So if you added that, okay. So the contract wasn't, the contract rates and the termination and agreement wasn't based on being the sole source provider? I mean, that's a huge difference. So if your contract said that, yes, we can bring in new products after a year to compete with your product, I would think that would have a significant impact on the contract and the rates that they offered you.
Hi, Senator. Colin Brewer, CFO. The procurement that we're all referencing were actually two separate procurements, one for HMO products and one for PPO products. So I believe, and I would love to read all the details of the procurement code, but my understanding would be that if we decided to issue a new RFP for HMO products, that is a separate RFP than the one that was awarded on the single PPO. Okay. And like the director had alluded to, we also have termination for either cause or convenience in all of our contracts. So I don't think, given the amount of time it would take to procure a product, that we could ever do anything for the upcoming year. But if we were to exercise those rights within the contract and issue a new RFP at a future date, that is possible. So,
if there was cause, if there was cause. So you're saying that their agreement wasn't based on the fact that they were going to be the sole source provider for 5 years, that they're fully aware of the fact that we could add additional products year two or three to compete with their product, so they wouldn't be the sole source. That wasn't part of their agreement that you have with them.
Under the RFP that was soliciting for a PPO product, we would have to issue a new RFP. We couldn't just add a second one because they do have.
Right, but you could add an HMO product. So their
we would have to
their
do an
sole
RFP
source
for that.
Their sole source PPO quote wasn't based on the fact that you could not, if you could, you would be allowed to issue a HMO plan or another non-PPO plan, you could issue that to compete with them, and that doesn't affect that contractual agreement rate. The agreement wasn't they're the sole source provider for 5 years.
Right. While they were separate procurements, I would have to assume that all respondents to the RFPs understood that we were running both of those RFPs concurrently, so we did have the authority to exercise an award for an HMO product at the time we were also awarding PPO. So they did, knowing that we were going out for the entire universe of services.
Okay, so there's no contract. There's nothing in the contract that says you can't add, if you wanted to, a second product next year or the year after.
To be 100% certain, I would like to get that answer to you when I can go back and look at the contract specifically for the language, and I'll be happy to do that.
It's great to see you here, by the way. We've been here for many, many years. So thank you. Thank you.
All right. And this is going to take all day at this rate, so we need to figure out how to speed this up a little bit. Any other questions of this panel? And they'll be able to come back and answer any other questions that we might have. So thank you very much. We're asking them, the Aetna panel, to please come up. And I'd like to try to condense these into about 10-minute time frames if we can. I know that there's going to be lots of questions that we have, but I'd like to try to get through this. I just asked about whether there's any availability of the room for tomorrow, and there's not, so we need to try to get through this the best we can. So welcome, and please introduce yourself, and I'm afraid we have one microphone that works and one that doesn't, so it's this microphone here that works. So please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, my name is Colin Puff, and I'm the Associate Vice President of Network Development. I'm not on the agenda.
I'm Brittany Salinas, and I'm a Director of Account Management within our Group Retiree Solutions team within Aetna.
My name is Joyce Masek. I'm the Executive Director of our Medicare Star Ratings Program, and we are here today. Unfortunately, our Group Vice President, Rick Frohmeyer, was unable to attend. He fell ill, and so we are representing him.
Well, you've heard the discussion, so if you can try to address some of the questions and the concerns that we have, and that is about people that are you know, not able to have a smooth transition. How do we deal with that, and what kind of networks do you have throughout the state?
For, I believe I heard some chatter around the transplant members, and I know Mr. Alon, you'll be testifying later, and can't wait to hear from that. So we have a national medical excellence program, so to help navigate all of those patients throughout, because obviously transplants are they're pretty catastrophic, and so we want to make sure that it's a one-to-one ratio, making sure that we're managing those patients all the way. Oh, sorry. I don't like to yell. No, so we have a national medical excellence program used to have guide those patients on the transplant list, basically step-by-step on a one-to-one ratio. So we encourage those patients to actively call at the national medical excellence program.
Senator Ross?
Yeah, first of all, and I'm going to reiterate this. Larry has been wonderful to work with on behalf of most of my constituents. I do know that Mr. Alanya is still waiting for a phone call back from you guys. And by the way, CMS, he provided his HIPAA waiver, you know, almost a month ago. So it's not a HIPAA issue. You know, I do just want to reiterate that this isn't about Aetna, because I do believe it's a good plan for a lot of people, just not people in my area necessarily. That said, he's done a great job trying to help us navigate since last year when this whole thing started, which obviously CMS should have known there was going to be a problem. But my question is this. The formulary, we've got 2 weeks for people to make a decision. You've got Thanksgiving in there, okay? A lot of these folks are older folks that don't have access to a computer, and if they do, they're not necessarily the best at typing into it. So when are they going to have the information they need to make a decision? And that's not a criticism, because quite frankly, you guys were thrown into this mess by CMS's negligent, grossly negligent rendering of this entire RFP. So how soon will you guys have the formulary so that constituents can make an informed decision? Because if they're going to go somewhere else, they've got to make that choice as well before November 30th.
So the formulary is available online today, but for members who maybe aren't comfortable with accessing the formulary online, they can call Aetna Member Services, our toll-free number, and have that conversation with one of our customer care representatives to go through each individual drug to determine what tier that drug is on and what copay they would be responsible for paying. This is also something that we've provided throughout the open enrollment meeting that CMS mentioned earlier.
So the question I had before, that I want to ask you, is that how will you handle the exceptions in this? Most people will have a smooth transition, understand that, but there's going to be some exceptions. So how do you deal with the exceptions?
So we're committed to providing sort of continuity of care and a smooth transition for those onesies, twosies that may be caught in limbo. We certainly don't want to leave anyone in limbo. We would encourage the member to call Aetna Member Services to have that conversation with our individual care team to alleviate any concerns they may have about their provider still being in network or what the coverage may look like.
Senator Sivan?
In complex cases, whether it's transplant or others, you have the, in most cases, it's the it's a surgical team, it's the provider that's calling member services and getting the approval, doing the negotiating, and getting that done. Now, if this is an out-of-network provider and the policy hasn't gone into effect yet, the coverage hasn't gone into effect yet, how are those communications? Can a non-network provider make a call to Aetna Services, do their peer-to-peer review or whatever they have to do for those procedures, even though it's the policy that person's not covered yet? Is that in place? And do those surgical teams or hospitals know how to deal with that? I mean, they clearly deal with out-of-network cases all through history. I mean, this isn't unique. Obviously, it happens with others as well when it's an open access type of a policy. But is that in place now for physicians or hospitals to make those calls to get pre-approval for, you know, surgery the first week of January or second week of January coming up?
As I understand it, yes.
Okay. All right, and then if the individual does go out of network and is and it's going to be covered the same, is there any additional out-of-pocket costs for that consumer if they are using an out-of-network physician? Is there any? The doctor says, "Yeah, we'll go ahead and we'll take what Aetna is, but we." There's still some things that Aetna's not going to pay that we're still going to bill for. Are there some potential costs that that consumer or that employee, retiree, could face by seeing a out-of-network provider or having out-of-network services?
If a member saw an out-of-network provider, it is possible.
So they could, okay.
Just to add a clarifying point, so the TRAIL program, the retiree receives the same level of benefits, coverage, coinsurance, whether they see an in-network or an out-of-network provider. There's no change from a retiree perspective in terms of the coverage or copay.
The coverages are the same, but are there some services that being at an out-of-network provider that Aetna may not cover that retiree potentially could have to pay out of their own pocket? So of the covered services, approved covered services, that's correct. What about if it's out of network, if there are some costs or tests or things that are not approved as part of your in-network or your preferred network process that a person could potentially pay more? And I mean, that happens anytime you go with an out-of-network provider. I just want to make sure that there's a notification that employees clear that you can use this doctor, we're going to pay potentially the same, but you could end up with some additional out-of-pocket costs.
Short answer, yes. If that member is truly in a transplant situation, there would be a lot of communication going back and forth between, to your point, the care teams and the insurance companies involved. So they wouldn't be left behind. So I just want to make sure.
Well, I guess I'm not talking about transplant because that's a complex case. Even if you're in network, you have to get a pre-approval, and you've got a lot of negotiating going on, whether you're in network or out of network. I'm just talking about any one-offs, a heart surgery where a doctor may ask for a second test. That Aetna would say, well, if you're in our network, we don't pay for that. But if the doctor is ordering that out of network, is that a potential cost that retiree could have because it's not in an agreed in-network provider?
Again, short answer, yes, it is perhaps that way. However, federal CMS does have a 100% of Medicare fee schedule that is out there. It gives a baseline for what those potential charges should be.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, any other questions? We're going to try to move along. I'd like to be down here. We'll shoot for noon for all of the testimony and that, but thank you very much. And you'll stay around in case there's questions afterwards. Thank you. At this point, we'll have United Healthcare come up to the panel. And again, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Dee Dee Raybach. I am the account vice president. I work for United Healthcare, and thank you for having me this morning.
Good morning, Jeff Renzi. I'm the vice president of client management with United Healthcare. Thank you for your time, and if I could also just quickly say thank you for the past 10 years of partnership, we greatly appreciate it.
And if you don't mind, I would respectfully like to just make some comments if I could, so thank you. I do want to just point out the RFP, a very rigorous RFP. It was based on scoring for both pricing and technical, and it's my understanding that from a pricing standpoint, both United Healthcare and Aetna scored equally. We also provided a 5-year contract at a $0 premium, which is what Aetna put on the table. It was mentioned that the technical piece was based on customer service, quality of care. There were a lot of parts to that technical aspect of the RFP. It's my understanding that United Healthcare lost by, I want to say, 16 points. That was 16 points out of maybe 15 or 1800 points. And when you look at our contract that we have with federal CMS, so with Medicare, we have a 5-star contract. That means that we are rated the highest that a Medicare Advantage contract can be rated. And that is based on quality of care. That is based on, you know, how well the consumer is getting services from that Medicare Advantage plan. So I do want to point that out. And in addition, I think it was mentioned that we did not offer silver sneakers, which is a highly sought after benefit of your retirees. We did offer Renew Active, which is actually a more robust network than silver sneakers. So we believe that we were even bringing more to the table. So I will just pause right there. And again, I respectfully just wanted to make some comments based on some comments that have been made this morning.
Okay, well, thank you for your comments. Any questions?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I just say one other thing?
Sure.
Barnes is in our network, and it is also one of our centers of excellence for transplants. So I did want to point that out as well.
Okay. All right. Moving right along, we're going to ask the retiree representative organizations. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
To come up, we have panel 3A, which includes Retired State Employees Association, Illinois Retired Teachers, State Universities Annuitants, and AFSCME. And after this, Mr. Alanya, I understand that you drove in the snow to get here. We're going to have you next, if you would make a few comments after that, and then we'll go with our panel 3B. So welcome, and introduce yourselves and proceed. I'm sorry we have one working microphone, unless that, can you get that?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I'm Rick Carlson, the second vice president of the Retired State Employees Association. With me is Gail Finnegan, who's our president, and Randy Witter, who's our first vice president. We represent almost 10,000 retired state employees who live throughout the state of Illinois, and there's 15% of those members that live in 47 other states, Puerto Rico, and the District of Columbia. We're pleased to have this opportunity to share with you our concerns of our nearly of our members. We've heard from many of them, particularly those that live out of state, that their doctor has advised them that they will not accept the new plan with Aetna. We've had over 130 members drive to our last membership meeting in Springfield, and have had hundreds of other members call or email advising us that they're happy with their current coverage with United Healthcare and are terribly upset about losing their existing coverage. They don't understand why this change is being made. While our members have overwhelmingly preferred staying with United Healthcare, we're not opposed per se to the state changing our Medicare Advantage coverage to Aetna if the transition from United to Aetna is seamless and our state retirees do not experience any difference in coverage or benefits. This includes that all of us can continue to see our current doctor who has been covered under the United plan, whether the doctor is in or out of network, anywhere in the United States, as long as they accept Medicare assignment. Based on the answers that Aetna has given us to numerous questions about access to providers, medical and prescription drug benefits at a TRAIL MAPD open enrollment meeting in Springfield last week, it appears that the benefits will be the same. We are told that the deductibles, copays, and out-of-pocket maximums will be the same. We're also told that other specific benefits that are broader than under regular Medicare will also continue under the Aetna plan. The exception we clearly have identified is with hearing aids. Currently, our retirees must go to a hearing provider that is in UnitedHealthcare's network, and that provider then bills United, who has agreements with certain hearing aid companies to accept United's approved rates. This means the retiree has not had to pay out-of-pocket for any of the costs and has been able to receive top-of-the-line hearing aids that retail for as much as $4,000 each for the maximum $2,500 benefit. Under Aetna, we are told that there will be no network and that retirees will have to pay the provider the full retail price with no discounts. Our members will then have to submit a copy of their paid invoice to Aetna for reimbursement up to the maximum benefit of $2,500, regardless of what they had to pay the provider. Beyond the hearing aid issue, our biggest concern remains with access to providers who are not part of Aetna's network and how Aetna will manage our insurance claims. Most of the calls and emails we've received are from our members concern their doctor or other provider telling them that this provider will not accept the Aetna plan. At the Crown Plaza meeting last week here in Springfield, an Aetna group Medicare account representative told us that our members could go to any provider that accepts Medicare and agrees to bill Aetna. That sounds good, but our concern is, does the provider need to agree to bill Medicare, Aetna, only for the state MAPD plan, or is Aetna using this as leverage to get these providers to agree to accept all of their Medicare Advantage plans? Another related concern is why Aetna, in its printed material regarding the state MAPD plan, refers to a PPO network with an extended service area instead of using passive PPO with the same benefits in or out of network that CMS is using. We believe that any costs that our retiree members end up incurring from out-of-network providers who accept Medicare assignment and accepted the UnitedHealthcare MAPD plan but will not accept the Aetna plan will constitute a diminishment of benefits in our existing health care plan. As all of you know, most state retirees devoted years to public service and have relied on the state of Illinois to keep its promise to continue to provide premium health care benefits for them and their dependents for the rest of their lives. As Senator Rose mentioned, the Illinois Supreme Court in the Canerva case, which we helped bring, ruled that these benefits are constitutionally protected and cannot be diminished. So, Mr. Chairman, we're, again, so pleased that you agreed to have this hearing and have allowed us to share these concerns with you. Be happy to answer any questions.
And we're going to bring up the Aetna folks again after this, and I'm sure they're taking notes and they're going to address those issues. Any questions from the? All right.
The one thing I will interject in the questions that Senator Severson was asking, the real issue on the out-of-network is going to be, when you're saying, are the retirees going to be out-of-pocket? If a provider agrees to accept Medicare assignment, they agree to accept the Medicare limiting rates and not balance bill.
Right.
If they just agree to accept Medicare but will not bill Medicare, that means that when the retiree submits a claim to Aetna, that the provider can then turn around and balance bill. So
that's
the retiree will be out of pocket.
Yeah, that is a big issue. So I'd like to have Aetna address the balance billing issue. Yeah. Yeah, Dave?
Yeah, Rick, I do have, I guess, one quick question. On that case, even if a doctor is accepting Medicare, they don't have the ability to collect over Medicare-approved charges. I mean, or I should say that they could bill over Medicare-approved, but the patient is not required to pay over Medicare-approved regardless of what the doctor bills. Is that correct?
Well, as I understand, the distinction, and you know, I've been retired 20 years, so, but the distinction is between accept Medicare and accept Medicare assignment. If a doctor or other provider agrees to accept Medicare assignment, they're agreeing to accept what Medicare pays as payment in full and cannot balance bill. But if they don't accept Medicare assignment but accept Medicare, then my understanding is they can balance bill. And
I think you're wrong. I think the difference is when someone says they accept Medicare assignment, that means if all they have is Medicare and they have no supplement or anything else, they take Medicare only and they can't balance bill.
Well, I hope that's the case.
So I'm pretty sure that's the case.
Yeah.
So in this case, when they say we take Medicare, not Medicare assignment, they say when they take Medicare, that means they take Medicare plus a supplement or Advantage or some other coverage. Either way, they cannot bill over Medicare-approved charges. So I think they're still protected that way. And last question is on doctors. I called a couple of our providers, and if it's a passive PPO, not a true closed network Advantage plan, most of the doctors will still bill. They'll bill it just like you would a supplement plan because it almost works. A passive open network plan like this is almost like a supplement plan. So most of the doctors, if they're concerned about their patient, will still bill on behalf of that patient to that company just like they would a non-contracted supplement plan.
Yeah. During the whole 9-plus years that this plan with UnitedHealthcare has been in place, in terms of the feedback, either to me personally or to our other officers or our members, we have not encountered any providers that will not accept the state plan with UnitedHealthcare, with the exception of Mayo Clinic in Arizona and Florida. And then they got into the situation that I was describing. I also, we'll get out of here, but I've enjoyed working with, before I retired, I was the assistant director of the insurance department for 8 years, and then first executive director of the state's CHIP plan. So I had the opportunity of working with Senator Severson a lot, and he was a very valuable proponent of my program. So it's good to see you again.
All right. So that was panel 3A, is that correct? So, Mr. Alon. Mr. Retired, okay, that's what I wondered. So we now have the Illinois Retired Teachers, is that correct? And I thought that was great that there was one spokesperson there, so. Welcome. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Okay. Hello, chairpersons and members of the commission. My name is Roger Hampton, and I'm representing the Illinois Retired Teachers Association, the largest public employee retiree organization in Illinois. On behalf of over 40,000 members, I would like to provide the following points. Unlike other public employees, our members contribute to their health care costs, both as active employees and as retiree members. We have a vested and ongoing concern for our health care, both as payers and as end users. We rely on CMS to administer our federally guaranteed benefit. This benefit is further protected by federal contract law and by the Illinois Constitution. Our organization represents individuals who are seniors. who are often frail and who may experience ongoing health care treatment to treat chronic illness. As a user of this benefit, I understand that CMS must tweak the plan in order to keep health care both low cost and effective. My concern and our complaint is that CMS made major plan design changes affecting retirees at the last minute and without any consultation with or advertisement to the IRTA. Both CMS changed both the administrator and the structure of the plan without any advance notice. I understand that the contract terms did expire and the new administrator had been brought on. I do not believe that any contract for health care administration should be evergreen, nor do I criticize CMS for switching providers consistent with the RFP process. I understand that eliminating the HMO option and moving to a single sole source provider may make sense. What I do not and cannot understand is making the change without any transparency as to how the decision was made. What I do not and cannot understand is making the decision without any input from the payers and end users through any type of public meeting. What I do not and cannot understand is not disclosing these structural changes in a way that allows retirees who are fighting cancer, diabetes, mental health trauma, and chronic conditions to pursue approval for ongoing medical treatment and from their new provider. What I do not and cannot understand is contracting with healthcare administrators without examining the outcome to retirees living in rural and underserved communities. As of today, many members have not received the information packet regarding the Aetna Medicare Plan PPO, so they cannot make an informed decision before the end of November 2022. I do appreciate the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability in having this public meeting. I appreciate the General Assembly wants to hear from retirees on issues as important as senior health care. I wish, and I am hopeful in the future, CMS will want to have some transparency and it would express the same concerns. I gave a better part of my life to the students of Illinois and did to all our members at IRTA. I believe that is not too much to ask that CMS give us a little heads up and involvement in changes that so dramatically impacts our lives. Thank you for listening to our concerns today.
Thank you, Roger. Any questions?
Quick
Senator
one.
Rose?
Did you say that your members have, many of your members still have not received information on this?
No, I just received the packet from Aetna last night before I left home in Peoria. And it still doesn't have all the information, but it did have some new information for me that I had heard was different. Like if I Walgreens, I go to there and it looks like I will have to pay a different cost at Walgreens than CMS. So I'm wondering what other things are out there that I still don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you,
Roger. We're now going to have the State Universities and New Entrants Association. So if you'd come forward. Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Linda Brookhart, the Executive Director of the State Universities Annuitants Association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. SUAA's advocacy represents all of the individuals in the State University's retirement system. I will start out by complimenting Aetna on its presentations that they've been doing throughout the state. I thought that they were very formative and very structured. And I will also compliment CMS as they have been very, they respond to me very quickly on my questions that I have had taking them forward. However, I have found out that there are problems that have been detected, and one of the ways I found this out was through the Carl problem, and I can't tell you the number of telephone calls I received. Along with, we decided to do an out-of-state Zoom meeting for anyone that might be interested. We have 3,000 out-of-state members. We had not heard from out-of-state members with the change. And since we hadn't really heard anything, we thought everything was pretty copacetic here. But after our meeting, our Zoom meeting, we found out that there's an area in Florida that all of you are very familiar with called the Villages. There's 135,000 people that live there. Many of them are from the state of Illinois, and many of them are teachers, but also state workers and university personnel, former personnel. They have been told that because they have their own healthcare system there, they have been told that there is no way that they will accept Aetna, the Illinois MAPD plan. Now, they did under UnitedHealthcare, but they will not under Aetna. So then there was another group that contacted me because in Florida, there is a group called Advent WellCare Plus 65. And it seems that the MAPD plans have become very competitive throughout the United States. Carl has one. Everybody has a plan that they want. And so it becomes very confusing to our retirees in the state of Illinois when they're told, no, you need to go with our MAPD plan. So what I have been told is that the Villages only want people to accept the AARP MAPD plan, and others, they want them to take on the Advent WellCare Plus Florida, 65 plan, which is another MAPD plan. So I'm not sure how we get by some of these things, but one of the things that I will say is that there is a hospital in Chicago, the University of Illinois Healthcare, and I'm sure Aetna will want to address this because they are finalizing, this hospital is finalizing a 3-year contract renewal with Aetna. Notice I said 3 years. Our plan is 5 years. Aetna is one of the worst partners in our management care portfolio. The reimbursement is amongst the lowest of national players, our payers. The administrative requirements are geared towards Aetna's ability to render denials of service. They give little consideration to the benefit they receive as one of the benefits offering for our state employees. I'm sure they will act with same disregard to our retirees. If not for the disruption in care it would cause to our employees and now retirees, I'd recommend to your leadership that we do not do business with Aetna until they provide market competitive reimbursement and industry standard operations as part of the continuing contractual relationship.
And who is that from?
This is from the University, our Illinois, the University of Illinois Hospital at UIC Healthcare. So, and I've heard many people say that they love Aetna. I've heard many people say that they've had problems with Aetna. So I sometimes think that some people don't understand their health care plan. So, you know, HMOs are limiting, PPOs are not. But when I have people coming to me, and no matter how they have stated, talked to their health care provider, and they say no way will they take Aetna regardless, this becomes a problem for our members, well, all of the state retirees. And as you know, and it's been mentioned, that these retirees were guaranteed health care for the rest of their life. So free, which they're not, it's not free. I think that there ought to be another way to address and make sure that whether you're in state or out of state, that you will get the health care that you were promised. And I know two other gentlemen that would like to comment on the Carl situation. And I will say that Carl did not help the situation either, because I have proof that Carl was trying to sell their MAPD plan to the state retirees, and said that the only way that this would be settled is if all the retirees that were in the area that Carl has would come to their Health Alliance MAPD plan. But now I see that this is going elsewhere. It's not just Carl. Others are joining in, that they want our retirees to be part of their MAPD plan. I will also say that I do understand that probably the Illinois MAPD plan, the trail, is of the best of an MAPD plan. But if you can't get a doctor, then it's not a good plan. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
And if you have brief comments, we're trying to move this along so we can get done by noon. But John, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to truncate what I was going to say quite a bit, which is unusual for me. I've been a retiree since 2000. Oh, I'm sorry. I was truncating too much. I'm John Marlin. I'm president of the University of Illinois Champaign chapter of the State Universities Annuitants Association. And on behalf of thousands of retirees in East Central Illinois, I want to thank you for having this hearing. Regarding some of the contacts with CMS, CMS early on assured us that there would be no problem because the, quote, plans were essentially the same and Aetna had a, quote, relationship with Carl. To CMS, the same plan meant their contract provisions were the same. To retirees, it meant that their health care options would remain the same. So we were speaking different languages using the same words. We were told not to worry because Carl had a relationship with Aetna. What they didn't tell us was that relationship was not in our specific area and that it involved some other program types. Again, they used words that put us at ease despite the fact that there was a big problem looming. Now, skipping down a bit, we're very happy that Carl and Aetna have an agreement. We don't understand the business reasons for the initial problem. We don't know which of them was considered to be unreasonable. We're just grateful for them coming to an agreement. We would point out, and this is a situation that is going to expand to other parts of the state, probably including the suburbs, Carl is the dominant health care provider in several areas that include Champaign, Vermilion, and Coles counties. It has facilities in Iroquois, McLean, and Richland, and is in the process of acquiring hospitals in Peoria and Tazewell. It is unconscionable that CMS did not verify that retirees would be accepted by Carl, given its size and influence in the area. I'll skip down further now, but other situations like Carl's expansion are happening in other places, so this issue is not going to go away for the next time. I want to point out the issues we're dealing with here are very complex. It's critical to the welfare of our senior citizens. Retirees include Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Independents, and Contrarians. It's a perfect opportunity for bipartisanship within the legislature. There is now, given the agreement, there's time to consider options during the next legislative session, although the problem at hand with people having transplants, et cetera, need to be looked at. In terms of options, I'm not sure we couldn't have a second PPO that would cover a different part of the state better. With it, retirees remember and believe they were promised health care that would be provided at no cost if they completed 20 years of service. They were surprised to find out that in the Medicare program under Part B, they have to pay $165 per month, often for each spouse. So it's not free. And something that might be considered is picking that up, since the state is no longer paying $440 million a year for the health care. Other people who fall under the IRMA can pay as much as $500 each month. The trend toward consolidating medical providers and pharmacies is continuing, and
John, we're going to lose this room at 11:45 because there's another meeting scheduled here, so we need to move right along.
Okay, then I guess I'll conclude then, and I can talk to some of you later.
Yeah, we'll get him next.
Okay, I'm Rich Wanling, and I'm a board member of Eastern Illinois University's Annuitant Association, also a past president. I'll be brief to the point on this. A lot of the same levels of anxiety, uncertainty that have been expressed today, we experienced them at Eastern. One additional kind of element I'd like to draw attention to is not only did we have members who were concerned about who their physicians might be come January 1st, but expressed great concern about the possibility of not being able to have a practitioner take them on. In our part of the state, that is a repeated issue. Two other things real quickly is that transparency and accountability are needed. WCIA did great work in getting information out, but we should not have to rely on WCIA for initial information, and I will affirm the importance of having choice, including United Healthcare as one of the options. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to ask Mr. Ilania to please give testimony, and then we're going to come back to AFSCME and the Champaign County Healthcare Association, and then we're going to ask for a response from Aetna. So, Mr. Alania, welcome, and I'm sorry that you have to be brief, but that's the order of the day. So.
Okay, well, thank you for letting me have a chance to speak up. I also speak for, I just found this number out last night. There's over 200 people on the transplant list that are retired state of Illinois employees, and 17 people a day die on waiting list for organ transplants. And I myself am stage 4 failure in liver and kidney both. I've gone through 8 years of testing and rising up the list at Barnes Hospital, and they've been excellent to work with, and I'm at or near the top of the list. Now I've been called twice for transplants, but just because you're called and they prep you for surgery doesn't mean when the organs arrive that they're useful, and that's happened to me twice. So I could go at any time and be called for a transplant. But right now I'm forced in a corner. I've got less than 2 weeks, if you take out Thanksgiving, to make a choice whether to accept staying on the Aetna plan or trying to shop around and find outside insurance. And it only makes sense to me that if I was in the insurance business, I wouldn't want to sell me insurance knowing that there's a big bill coming. And I sense that Aetna wants to separate the active employees from the retired employees because everybody knows that younger, healthier people don't cost as much. And if you can keep the cream of the group, low cost, and then deprive the retirement people that are high cost, I can see the bottom line for that. But I hate to see the state of Illinois abandon their most loyal employees. I myself, I'm 70 years old right now, and I've got 39 years of service at retirement time. That's over half my life that I dedicated to the job as a fire marshal for the state of Illinois. And I hate to see people in my position get thrown under the bus to make it more profitable for everybody involved. And I just hope that people can think this over and come up with a way to handle this. Barnes Hospital has been excellent for me to deal with, and they dealt with me through the transplants through Health Alliance. And Health Alliance, as soon as they were approached, said, we want to give this guy a transplant. They signed off for it. They said, it's guaranteed, no problem. They don't have a signed agreement with Aetna, and they said that Aetna would not sign an agreement. They want billed, and then maybe they'll refuse to pay, and they can't do business that way. These surgeries are expensive, and they want guarantees up front that they're getting paid. And I don't blame them. I'm a businessman myself. And I started off trying to get this settled with CMS, and I got to a supervisory level, and I could phone directly and talk to that representative until it came crunch time and we were running out of time. Now I don't get return phone calls from there. I reached out to Senator Rose, and he helped me. He got involved, and when he tried to deal with Aetna, and I'd signed all the HIPAA releases, so that's a no-brainer. They replied that they wanted to deal with me directly, but I'd never heard from them. So it leaves me in a lurch, and less than 2 weeks to decide. And me being refused is just a death sentence. It's that simple. I can't live without a liver and kidney. And all I'm asking is to somebody give me answers. Don't have me leave voicemails that don't get returned or emails that don't get returned. Just talk to me straight up and let me know what I can do to stay alive. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, please don't abandon your most loyal employees. We stayed all of our life here retired. So thanks for letting me speak.
Yes. Can somebody get him a card from Aetna and get back him? So, Mr. Lanny, if you'll see folks right there, and you'll get a card and you'll get a conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. So, ask me. And the last one then is the Champaign County Healthcare Association. Is there somebody here from that?
They are provided written testimony. They cannot
okay.
be here today.
Okay, that's fine. So, you're the last.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Members of COGSA, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to address you this morning. My name is Joanna Webb-Gobbin. I'm the Director of Political and Legislative Affairs for AFSCME Council 31, and I'm here on behalf of the tens of thousands of AFSCME-represented state and university employees and retirees that participate in the state's group health insurance program. Retirees across the state appreciate your attention to the TRAIL MAPD program this morning. And we hope the information obtained here will be used to better inform processes when the state goes out to bid contracts related to the group insurance program. We've heard from CMS today that the improvements to the TRAIL program from the upcoming plan year achieved significant savings through the new PPO contract with Aetna, enabling them to maintain the current plan design while greatly reducing premium contributions for plan participants. Anticipated that plan participants could save up to $1,000 a year, and that is significant savings. We are not here to dispute that. I would like to take this opportunity to discuss the group insurance procurement process as well as the FY23 plan rollout. First, to clear up any misinformation that was going around, the changes to the upcoming 2023 TRAIL program were not discussed with AFSCME until decisions were all but finalized, including determination to overhaul the program and not to award an MAPD HMO contract, even though many of the elements of the health insurance plan are included in the AFSCME collective bargaining agreement with the state of Illinois. CMS informed us that they were precluded from discussing the TRAIL program changes with AFSCME because of procurement rules, and therefore they moved ahead unilaterally. Had the state talked with us, we could have identified during the decision-making process, we could have raised our concerns and addressed some of these issues related to the collective bargaining agreement, most notably the inclusion of an HMO contract. Rather, we were left to react after the fact. And as a result, we have filed a grievance challenging the decision to eliminate the MAPD HMO contract or HMO option. I do want to stress to hear today that AFSCME remains committed to continued conversations with the state to ensure that all retirees have access to first-rate health insurance and the quality health care services, which I do believe is the goal of all concerned. In addition, in our view, the significant changes in the 2023 plan year took much too long to communicate with retirees. After the previous speaker, I don't think I need to go in to elaborate on the stress and the uncertainty that retirees felt during the summer and into the fall. There's a lot of unnecessary worry. To the extent that the procurement and the participant communication timetables can be modified to avoid any future uncertainty, we would encourage the state to look at making those kinds of changes. Transitions are rarely smooth, but this one seems particularly bumpy. We are already hearing from our retiree members about problems that they are encountering. Despite assurances that provider disruption will be minimal, we've heard a number of issues related to provider access. We've also heard from the villages in Florida, as well as a few other pockets where we have out-of-state members. And to us, this raises issues or questions about what kind of information Aetna provided as part of its bid. Is it related to network adequacy? We have heard concerns from retirees who are extremely concerned about the lack of health plan options in the new TRAIL program. With only one health care provider, retirees fear that they're left with no alternatives. They understand that many of them aren't seeing problems with having access to the providers now, but they're afraid of what's going to happen in the future. And the recent problems between the state and Springfield Clinic, Blue Cross Blue Shield, the issues with Carl, that's very fresh in our members' minds. So even though the state wouldn't be able to offer, they understand that the decision to go with a PPO, that it might have saved, retirees might save enough money, they understand that an HMO option might cost them more money in premium contributions. We have a lot of members who feel like they still should have been given the ability to make that decision themselves. Premium contributions are one thing that people consider when making healthcare insurance coverage decisions. There are other components that go into that decision making. It's not just about the premium levels themselves. Lastly, I would be remiss if I failed to take this opportunity to mention the concerning trend regarding Medicare Advantage prescription drug plans altogether, MAPDs. In a report from the Inspector General's Office of the U.S. Health and Human Services Department issued earlier this year, federal investigators are noted that MAPD plans are denying necessary care that should be covered under the program. Audits are showing evidence of widespread and persistent problems related to inappropriate denials of service and payments, so that in hospitals and doctors have complained about MAPD plans, and some, such as Mayo Clinic, have stopped accepting them altogether. So we would just urge the state to closely monitor these trends as they move forward.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask for the acting director and somebody from Aetna would come up, and we have just a few questions, and then we are going to gavel out at 11:45. Again, I'm sorry that we have to all share a mic, but that's Senator Rose.
Thank you. I've got a couple quick technical questions from the testimony. First of all, to Aetna. So the formulary is available on the website now, which is new, but the packets obviously just went out to some people, including the gentleman the night before. Is this, someone made a statement that CVS is now cheaper than Walgreens. Is that accurate?
We do have a preferred pharmacy network, which includes CVS,
Walmart, Jewel, Meijer, Hy-Vee. There's a number of preferred pharmacies. Walgreens is not considered a preferred pharmacy.
Okay. So everybody in Walgreens is now going to have to switch to CVS to get a cheaper rate. Is that do I need to tell my people that?
They don't have to switch to CVS. They can go to any...
To get a cheaper rate, they're going to have to leave Walgreens.
For generic drugs, they receive a dollar less for a 30-day supply at a preferred pharmacy.
You met a senior citizen, a dollar is a lot of money. Okay. Is balanced billing going to happen or not going to happen? There was an interplay here with Senator Severson and some witnesses. And Senator Taylor asked that question as well.
Yes, so the member is held harmless. So I want to make sure that is clear. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Okay. So it could happen, but the member then has to do what?
The member would be kept out of the middle of it. That would work with the provider. So the provider could bill over and above what Medicare would allow.
Okay.
And
is hearing aids cheaper for seniors now under your plan than it was before, or is it the same, or is it more?
My understanding is it's the same benefit in terms of a $2,500 reimbursement per year.
Can you repeat that? What are you asking?
The same.
What are you asking?
Yeah, there was an insinuation that the hearing aids would be more expensive.
Oh, hearing aids. Okay.
And I don't remember who
said
that.
I need some.
I'm sorry.
Okay. I think you answered the question, which is you believe it'll be the same. Okay. That's all I have for Aetna. For CMS, do you agree that the hearing aids are going to be the same because someone said they're not?
Yes, I do.
Okay. What is the total savings to the state taxpayers from switching from Aetna to CVS? From United to Aetna?
For the state and the retirees, there's a total of a little over $1 billion over 5 years across three programs.
Okay. Then how many people are you counting on leaving and migrating over to some other plan, like the 200 transplant patients that would rather stick with United and just pay the difference out of pocket?
Can you repeat that, please?
Yeah. So there's a high likelihood that some amount of people are just going to go sign up for United by the end of this month to keep their transplant doctor at Barnes. How many people are you counting on migrating over to a different plan and off of Aetna? What's your internal number?
Well, our intent is zero.
What number did you assume? And don't tell me you assumed zero.
With respect to the estimated savings that I projected, I assumed that everybody that was currently in an HMO, along with natural population growth over time, was going to migrate to the PPO. I did not assume anybody was going to exit our program.
Okay. So if people do exit the program, how much will you save per person exiting?
Well, I guess it would still be the same amount of money, pretty close, because if they're in our program now and they're costing us something and they're moving to a $0 PPO, or they're moving to outside of our system, they're either way going to cost us $0, so the savings really wouldn't change.
Okay. All right. Got it. So,
and I think that issue right there, that's a risk to the senior citizen.
Well, that's right. That's what's happened because they're going to
get clobbered.
Mr. Alanya's got basically a week with Thanksgiving to switch plans.
Yeah,
and there's 200 Mr. Alanya's.
Well, I think we need to have a concerted effort to make sure that our retirees know that under this is part of their guaranteed health care. If they go outside of the system, they're going to get clobbered.
Well. Maybe, or maybe they've got access to a doctor in their area.
I know, but
I mean that's the
again,
problem.
I think the retirees need to stay within the system to be protected.
Well, right, but Mr. Alanya can't. He doesn't have that luxury.
Well, no, Aetna's going to work that out.
I hope so. So on that note, CMS, you guys issued there's no savings between United and Aetna, right? Okay. So you picked a plan that was 5-star in United last time, and now you went to a plan that's 4-star. So if there was no savings, what were the criteria you used to pick the plan? Because it wasn't quality.
So part of the technical elements included account implementation, customer service, operational and financial issues, medical management, utilization management, network access, and the clinical program management.
Okay, I believe that you believe that. Okay, but that's insane. The way this whole thing has unfolded has proved that wrong. This is the third time I've sat in this room having a meeting over this. Okay, now, last time Health Alliance was involved, this time they're not. Last time it was someone versus United and Aetna wasn't involved, now Aetna's involved. You guys know damn well there's a freaking problem. And then you unleash a program. Okay, I'm just going to boil this down. Because it really comes down to this. Aetna is a fine product for a lot of people. Fine product. And it's going to be great for a lot of people. But one size does not fit all. We've always offered choice. We've always offered an alternative. Okay? You knew damn well there was a problem in me and Representative Marin's neighborhood for the last year. And didn't seem to care. Literally didn't care. Representative Marin, ask you, was there any analysis of regional coverage, regional access? And the answer was no. And you knew it was going to be there because it's been there for the last 15 years. We have a short-term problem because this plan is in effect. We got 200 people like Mr. Alanya. We got other pockets. I've heard the Villages and I've heard UIC Medical Center in Chicago, which is also owned by the U of I, by the state of Illinois. The irony is just rich. But, you know, you've got those issues. You've got formulary info that's just gone out to people. And we got 14 days with Thanksgiving in the middle. How are we going to fix all this in the next 14 days? That's the short-term question. And when you answer that, I want you to answer this. Will you commit to actually working? Not calling me the day after the hearing's been announced and you find out your butts are coming in here. Because that's what happened. You called me after you found out there was going to be a hearing and said, "Oh, Senator Rose, are you going to be in that committee that day?" Well, why, yes, I am. Why, yes, I am. Are you actually going to work with me and Marin, who have filed bills to bring choice to our constituents? Because in 5 years, when this is up again, none of us should be having another stinking hearing. This is the third one of these I've done. So how are we going to help people in the next 2 weeks? And don't give me the crap HIPAA. You guys have had that. And by the way, answer that question. How come nobody called him back? Your staff.
That I apologize for. We have been doing a number of seminars and events to promote, you know, the program in terms of getting information out to the public. But we will follow up with the gentleman as well.
2 weeks. How are we going to fix all this?
We're gonna move along. Representative Merrill.
Let me answer. I want to hear his plan. And then I'm done. I'll shut up. What's the plan?
So we are continuing to do outreach. We have another 8 events to inform the public of all of their options. Yes, we are committed to working with you. We are committed to working with you.
Representative Mann.
Thank you. United Healthcare testified that throughout the extensive scoring process that they were within several points. I understand that during the RFP process, companies submit proprietary information, et cetera, so that can't be public. Are the actual scores available to the public? Is that something that we would have access to?
The scores are available now to the public.
Okay.
During the procurement process, we are prohibited from sharing any additional information to the public.
So in the procurement process in state law, is there anything that precludes, just if, especially in a situation like this where you have two companies that have relatively close scores, saying we'll just allow both options? Is there anything that's stopping this?
Well, I mean, currently under the procurement code, the evaluation team are not allowed to share any information to the public or anyone else.
And that's not what I'm asking. What I'm asking is, why not you have two finalists that have a good product on the table, they both score very high. What stops CMS from saying we're going to offer both options?
So the RFP went out as a solicitation to award one vendor.
Whose decision is that? Well, whose decision is that in structuring the RFP process, though?
CMS structured the RFP in that fashion.
So the main question that I'm getting to, that in the future, there's nothing in state law precluding the director of CMS from saying we could allow two, three, however many options.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Davidsmeyer, and then I'm going to make some final comments, and we're going to close the hearing.
I just have a couple quick questions for Aetna. To me, it feels like your company, your overall company, wears so many different hats, right? Aetna, CVS, Caremark, all these different groups. My concern is that you're showing a benefit to the state of Illinois on the Aetna healthcare side, and then you're making it up by driving everybody into your CVS pharmacies, where there may not be a CVS pharmacy in rural Barrie, Illinois, right? So my concern is that we're looking at somewhat of a healthcare monopoly, and there still is no other option from CMS, from the state of Illinois. So I want to put that on the record that I have big concerns about that. CMS on the trail side, on the teacher side, there's a statute that specifically discusses how much you can raise premiums. Since 2008, it has been 105% of the previous year. So if your premium is zero, my understanding is that you're going to charge a little bit more than that. What happens if in year six, Aetna comes back and says, we're going to have to go back to the $38? Because you can't charge it to retirees, you can't charge it to teachers, you can't charge it to school districts, I would assume. Does the state of Illinois cover the rest of that premium?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a conflicting portion in that particular statute that says that we have to charge retirees 25% of the cost. So now that the cost is basically our administrative cost of around $8, we're going to charge them $2. But if it goes up, then we will actually be kind of stuck by that 5% cap. So we've already had some internal discussions with CMS and folks in the administration that we will potentially have to seek a legislative exemption from that particular component of the statute in the event that there is an increase.
So in the future, I just want to make this clear, CMS will be coming back to us asking us to raise the cap on how much more you can charge. And I understand it's kind of a catch-22. You're going from $38 down to $2.06. But that
I guess let me back that up a little bit. I can't actually say that we're going to do that. I've let everybody in my agency, we've had discussions internally that this is an issue.
Yeah.
So I guess we shouldn't have gotten out in front of people and said that we will be coming back to you. If that were the case, we would be stuck with a 5% increase if we did not come back to you. So I don't want to get out in front of that. I'm sorry.
And I'm not putting this on you. I just want everybody here to understand that is the possible implications of these incredibly low premiums, is that when it does go up, and it will eventually go up, it has to go up, we're going to be stuck with that, paying that from the general revenue somehow, rather than sharing it the way it's been shared for the last 10 years. I mean, just that's the way my brain is working logically.
That's the strict interpretation of the statute that we'd have to abide by.
Thank you.
We're going to conclude the hearing. Let me just say there's one other issue that I don't want to take the time right now, but the State University's annuitants brought up the issue about the villages. So if that would please be addressed. Yes, we'll have them talk to you directly on that. Just thank you for indulgence in this subject matter hearing this morning. I thought it was important that we get all these issues out. We're in a position within the NCOGFA here that we can advise, but we don't necessarily consent. So, and I would say this in terms of advice that we might, you've heard a lot of advice around the table here today. But this has not rolled out real smoothly so far. And so we've got 2 weeks to go. We will be coming back with COGFA and doing a review of all of our health plans in April, as we do every year. And so this will certainly be on the agenda. We'll hopefully at least brought some of the issues to light and can maybe start some conversations that need to happen rather quickly. So we're not in a position of exerting any of our influence on the decisions that have been made, but certainly it's been, I think, our role to bring these issues to light because we're hearing a lot of noise out there. So with that, we'll conclude the meeting and thank everyone.